Hello and welcome to listen to this lecture on religion and nationalism in South Asia. This lecture will be in three parts. In this first part, I will discuss the origins of nationalism in South Asia from the year 1857 until 1947. In the second part, I will discuss religion and nationalism in Pakistan after 1947. And in the third part, I will discuss religion and nationalism in India after 1947. But let's begin with the term nationalism itself. At present, nationalism evokes negative associations and it is often linked with far-right groups. Some people who want to express their positive pride over their own country use the term patriotism. However, in this lecture I will use nationalism as a neutral term that depicts the belief that each nation is a sovereign nation and it will achieve its fullest self-manifestation in a nation state when it has the freedom to rule over itself. Each nation sees that it has a very long history that goes back as far as the history goes, but however, the idea of nation and nation state, the nationalism itself, is relatively new. Most researchers place the origins of nationalism to the 18th century, some to the North America, and some to the French Revolution. Whichever the case, the fact remains that the idea of nation-state and nation has been around only about 250 years. At present, this idea of nations and nation-states as the basis of the global political system is almost universal. The world is divided into nation-states, which negotiate with other nation-states on international affairs, and the nation-state also governs the life of its inhabitants, the citizens, through legislation. However, the nation-state is not a group whose existence is based on natural law. And this is the reason why the most famous theoretician of nationalism, Benedict Anderson, has called nation as an imagined community. By calling nation as an imagined community, he doesn't mean that the nation would somehow be would be unreal somehow. Because we can see in our life, in our world, that people are ready to die for their nation and people are also killed in the name of nationalism and nation-state. So it is a very real and concrete phenomenon. Instead, what he means by stating that a nation is an imagined phenomenon is that having an understanding and having an image of a nation as a group into which people who don't personally know each other belong is necessitated by the act of imagining. And according to Benedict Anderson, this imagining happens in two levels. First of all, it happens horizontally in the present, where the question is posed, who belongs to the nation? Who has the right to belong to the nation? And what are the criteria in the light of which the belonging to a nation is defined? In addition, this imagination happens vertically in the historical sense, and each nation has its history and series of historical events that will lead, usually through difficulties, into the self-determination and sovereignty of a nation in a nation state where it can govern itself. Anderson has also noted that remembering the national history is always very selective, because national history wants to pick up from the history only the events that somehow directly lead to the idealized present and to the idealized state of a nationhood. And remembering certain things also requires forgetting something. So remembering national history also usually includes certain dose of anamnesia, forgetting historical events that do not fit into this historical narrative. So let's begin our lecture by looking at what has happened, what are the origins of nationalism in South Asia. Nationalism is an idea that was imported to South Asia from Europe. Its growth is intimately linked with the establishment of the colonial rule of the British in the area. An important historical event in this respect is the 1857 uprising and its suppression by the British. The uprising began as a mutiny of soldiers of Indian origin in the army of the East India Company, but it soon became a popular uprising in which both soldiers and civilians took part. They took the last Mughal monarch, Bahadur Shah Zafar, as their figurehead. The Mughal ruler had no more political power, but he was a powerful symbol of the Indian imperial past. The uprising, however, failed. In the picture below, you can see Bahadur Shah, the last representative of the dynasty that had once been the most powerful and wealthiest in the world, reduced into a weak old man and sent into exile in Burma, that was also ruled by the British at the time. On the left is a grandiose statue of Queen Victoria of England located in Calcutta. After 1857, Victoria became the Empress of India and the rule of Indian dynasties was replaced by the colonial rule. The transformation of the British presence from a commercial company with its own army into a colonial bureaucracy necessitated a much more extensive colonial administration. This administration was so extensive that it could not be peopled with only persons of British origin and, as a consequence, Indians were also admitted into it. The British were highly suspicious of Muslims after the uprisings, since its figurehead had been a Muslim monarch and their preferred recruits were Hindus. The advancement of Hindus in the colonial administration was also due to the fact that they had been much more open to the British education system than Muslims. As a consequence, many of them knew English very well. Although the participation of Indian bureaucrats was essential to the success of the British colonial project, they also formed a class of people who were most susceptible for new political ideas and ideologies. This is because they were separate from the old local learned elites and aristocracy. They were free from the old learned traditions that were mostly based on pre-modern models. They did not belong to the local masses either, because they were educated and also operated outside the old locally determined loyalties. However, they were also separate from the British overlords. Even if they were educated in Cambridge and Oxford, spoke perfect English and wore tweed suits made in London, they could never equal the British because they were born in India. The fact that they would never reach the highest ranks of colonial administration brought effectively home the fact that despite their ties with the colonial administrations, they were still the ones who were ruled by the British. The idea of nationalism reached the class of colonial bureaucrats of Indian origins through the British education system and the British peasantry. Both celebrated the freedom of the British nation and extolled its glory. It was natural that the Indians would ask if freedom and sovereignty of nations is the highest value and the right of human beings, why would Indians be deprived of it? The conclusion was that freedom and sovereignty were also rights of the Indian nation. However, the problem was that the conception of India as a nation did really not exist at the end of the 19th century, and the Indians, inspired by the idea of a sovereign Indian nation, also had to define what the Indian nation was. In this process, they were largely affected by the exposure to the colonial knowledge production. They became acquainted with the British attempts to catalogue and classify the people they ruled. Although the British surveyed the different ethnic groups, social classes, and languages of India, the most important denominator of Indians for them was their religion. Belonging and loyalties were determined by the person's religion. The importance of religion was also reflected into the colonial historiography of India. The British periodized the Indian history with broad strokes according to religion. The old classical Golden Age was Hindu. The Golden Age was destroyed by Muslims who were foreign despots. And, eventually, the Indian nation was liberated from under their yoke by the enlightened Protestant British. Thus, the exposure of Indian bureaucrats to the British education and colonial knowledge production led to the emergence of nationalism. Nationalism in India assumed three different forms: the secular nationalism, Hindu nationalism, and Muslim nationalism. Because of the British obsession with religion when it came to defining the Indian identities and the Indian bureaucrats' adoption of this view, it was not surprising that nationalism became intimately tied with religion already in its inception. Even the secular nationalists had to very carefully take into consideration the questions of religious identities. The first strand of nationalism that took shape in India was secular nationalism. It began as an anti-colonial movement that concentrated on promoting the independence of Indian nation. Religion was not the main concern of secular nationalists. Secular nationalism became the political idea of a political party when Indian National Congress was founded in 1885 to promote the local interests in British India. When the British divided the province of Bengal into East and West Bengal according to the religion of the majority of its inhabitants, Hindus in the West and Muslims in the East, the National Congress led the opposition to this move, and because of this it became a mass movement that assumed the lead of the Indian independence struggle. The members of the National Congress had different views concerning the means of this struggle and those who should be included in this struggle. After Mahatma Gandhi returned from South Africa to India in 1915, the party adopted civil disobedience as its main form of opposition instead of direct agitation in the form of rioting and assassinations. It also began to unequivocally promote religious pluralism and inclusiveness instead of addressing only Hindus. As a result, the National Congress attracted followers from among all religions. In addition to Hindus like Mahatma Gandhi and Jawaharlal Nehru, its figureheads included Muslims like Abul Kalam Azad. Hindu nationalism had begun as a cultural movement already in the 1850s, and it had concentrated on imagining the Indian nation through redefining cultural phenomena and history. One of the most visible results of this process of imagining was the creation of modern standard Hindi. During the 19th century, Urdu was the lingua franca of educated urban population of northern India. However, its Perso-Arabic writing system and heavily Persianized vocabulary made it an unfit language for a Hindu nation. For this reason, supporters of Hindu nationalism codified a new language that borrowed its writing system and vocabulary from Sanskrit, the language of the Hindu Golden Age defined by the colonial historiography. Thus, modern standard Hindi was born. Ideological definition of Hindu nationalism was offered by Vinayak Damodar Savarkar in his book Hindutva, Who is a Hindu?, published in 1923. Hindutva is a Hindi word that translates the English term Hinduism into an Indic language. In this word, Savarkar defines Hindutva or Hinduism not as a set of religious beliefs, but as a cultural identity and a set of values. He goes on to define India as a Hindu country where all its citizens should adopt this identity and values irrespective of their religion. Thus, also Muslims could be citizens of India if they just behaved like Hindus. Their beliefs were of no great concern to Savarkar, to whom religion was essentially a cultural identity and a mode of behavior. However, if Muslims could become Indians by adopting a Hindu cultural identity, their loyalty to the country would always be under suspicion because the origins of their religion lie outside India. According to Savarkar, it is only Hindus, and this includes Buddhists, Sikhs and Jains, who are loyal citizens by natural disposition. While Savarkar was essentially an ideologue, a number of Hindu nationalist organizations were established to propagate his ideas in the Indian society. Among the most influential is RSS, Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, or the National Organization of Volunteers. RSS was founded in 1925 to promote Hindu culture and values. It organizes camps where participants are taught Hindu nationalist ideology and combat skills. The organization borrowed also from the European fascist organizations, beginning with the uniform and the idealization of the Hindu race. BJP, Bharatiya Janata Party or Indian People's Party, is a political party closely related to RSS, and it has acted in the political system of India. It is noteworthy that the Hindu nationalists did not participate in the struggle for independence in India because they did not approve of the inclusiveness and secularity of the National Congress. This disapproval went so far that a member of RSS, Nathuram Godse, assassinated Mahatma Gandhi in 1948. Hindu nationalists have established their political influence only in the independent India. Muslim nationalism is the only type of nationalism that owes its origin to old pre-colonial elite. As was already noted, very few Muslims worked initially in the colonial administration. When the British started to localize their rule and give more autonomy to the provinces of British India, where the representatives of legislative assemblies were chosen in elections, the old Muslim aristocracy and land-owning elite became alarmed that they would lose their privileges. Muslims were a minority in British India, and in most provinces they constituted less than 10% of the population. If the representatives were chosen by elections, the Hindus would of course win and take their vengeance on Muslims who had ruled over them for several centuries. This was at least what the Muslim elites in colonial India believed and also persuaded the British to believe. This led to the first step towards separating Hindus and Muslims in the political system by granting the Muslims separate electorates where Muslims would vote for Muslim candidates. The Muslim League was founded in 1906 to advance the interests of Muslims in British India and ensure that they would have appropriate political representation. The Muslim League, however, soon lost its significance and was resurrected only when Muhammad Ali Jinnah, a London-educated barrister, returned from London to India in 1930. The 1937 elections were crucial to Muslim League because it was by then apparent that the British would leave India sooner or later. National Congress had won in the majority of provinces in 7 out of 11, and it would become the successor of the British. To ensure that the elite Muslims would continue to enjoy their privileges after the British had left, the Muslim League metamorphosed into a mass movement that claimed to protect the interests of all Muslims. They started to propagate the creation of a new state, Pakistan, for the Muslims. The Muslim League adopted a highly divisive rhetoric. They claimed that Hindus and Muslims belonged to two different nations and they simply could not live in a single state. They claimed that if Muslims live with a Hindu majority, Islam would be in danger and Muslims would have to give up their religious observances, like calling the faithful to the prayer from the minaret of a mosque. The campaign was effective, and the Muslim League managed to carve Pakistan as a separate state from India. When the British left in August 1947 and India got its independence, two nation-states were formed out of the British India and Indian kingdoms instead of one. The glorified achievement of independence that is remembered every year in India and Pakistan was accompanied by the trauma of partition that is rarely mentioned in official contexts. The creation of India and Pakistan was extremely violent. 1 million people died, 2 million disappeared, and at least 10 million people crossed the borders, leaving their homes behind. In addition to the loss of lives, the partition also drew a wedge between India and Pakistan and between Hindus and Muslims. The glance at nationalism in Pakistan and India will show how deep this wedge goes.